You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Come on, Flip, this week as we get to know some of the new faces in the National League Central and we revisit one of the old rivalries. Terry, coming off the Cubs convention, I know lots of excitement in Chicago about this upcoming season, about all these new players. But, you know, you and I, we've done a lot of different things here, some predictions and whatnot. But how about a get-to-know-you podcast where maybe we just pick somebody out and you can help us, you know, Cubs fans and all, get to know this player and how you think they fit in. Who would you like to talk about today?
Well, I think kind of an obvious choice would be Ben Zobrist, mainly because he's a guy that Joe Maddon could not stop talking about last year in terms of the type of player that he wanted on the team. Zobrist signed, come over to the Cubs. He's projected to spend most of his time at second base, but Maddon kind of made him into the super utility guy when they were together in Tampa Bay. And Zobrist's career just took off. And Zobrist said the biggest thing about it is that Maddon really believed in him, and it translated into success.
What an interesting trajectory for a guy, right? Because for the longest time, a utility guy was, you know, a guy who could fit in nicely in different spots for folks and, you know, pick up some slack. We always thought of them as bench players, that second tier, if you will. But he comes with some really high expectations, and he is deservedly so. I mean, he's built himself into that player.
Right. And I guess it's just kind of fun to me to listen to somebody. You know, Maddon was lobbying during the All-Star break, or right before the All-Star break, Maddon was lobbying that they should create a super utility spot on the All-Star team, you know, because there are players probably like a Ben Zobrist on just about every team that is used all over the place and they don't get enough credit, and yet they're such valuable guys. I mean, Zobrist has played all the infield spots, all the outfield spots. Like I say, he's projected primarily at second base to fill in where Starlin Castro was. But it was just interesting to hear Ben talk at the during the Cubs convention. He was part of a panel on new Cubs, and he was mentioning that when he was 14 years old, he was only about 5 feet tall and weighed 98 pounds, and also that his voice hadn't quite changed, so he didn't really project himself as a big leaguer. Now he's 34. He's, you know, big piece of this Cubs puzzle as they're going forward, and it's really going to be interesting to watch his influence on the rest of the team.
Well, what do you think that influence is going to be?
I think what he brings is mainly he's been to the World Series, and I think that is something that, and to be perfectly honest, if I can make this quick little aside, I don't think I've ever heard the words World Series issued at a Cubs convention more than I did this past weekend. But anyways, okay, so back to Zobrist. He's been to the World Series. He can help sort of, you know, he knows what that takes, what's involved. He can just sort of guide guys through. He knows Maddon. He was telling me that it got to the point where even though Joe would play him all over the place, it got to the point where he could anticipate what Maddon was going to do. So he would kind of, you know, think ahead of the mad scientist a little bit and be prepared for whatever it took. And that's really a gift to try and outthink Joe. But it's paid off. And I think his preparation and his skills are really going to be a key thing here.
And I think it goes back to what you were saying, too, you know, where a super utility player like Ben Zobrist, it's one thing to get along or try to keep up with the skipper, but even if he didn't know where he was going to play, he does know that he is going to play, right? And that he's going to be most likely in the lineup. And and that's where that position is so critical. Where do you see him making, I mean, obviously we're going to see a lot of second base, probably left field. Do you anticipate him showing up in other places in the diamond?
Well, they could put him, you know, Joe likes to look at matchups too, you know, so he'll, I'm sure that they'll, I'm going to try and check on his splits from last year. You know, he might have him start in the outfield. There might be a time where Kyle Schwarber is catching and they need another outfielder so they could put Zobrist out there. Let's see. He hit 250 against right-handers and 320 against lefties. So that would be almost a perfect situation to have him out there. I think I kind of got the impression, though, that even though he was a super utility guy with the Rays, I got the impression he might sort of stay put a little bit more this year with the Cubs than he has in the past. I don't know if Joe is going to use him quite as much all over the place, because they do have some pretty good pieces around, you know, around the team. I mean, Addison Russell said at shortstop, you know, I don't know if maybe they want to give Chris Bryant a breather, if they want to put Zobrist over at third. You know, it might give Anthony Rizzo a breather, put him over at first. I mean, I was looking at the depth chart today. They went through the whole year last year without a backup first baseman, and right now they really don't have anybody either. So at some point you got to give Rizzo a chance to just sort of catch his breath. But you know, we might see him sort of everywhere a little bit.
Jen, the winter warm-up, it's in the books. Good time. Anything interesting come out of the weekend?
Yeah, you know, and I think the timing of winter warm-up couldn't have been better for the city of St. Louis. It was a rough week last week, obviously, with the Rams announcing that they'd be relocating to Los Angeles. So I think to have a little bit of distraction, bring baseball back, was certainly welcome here in St. Louis. Most of the players on the current roster were here in attendance, as well as a lot of former players. A nice celebration of the 06 World Championship team, now that it's the 10th anniversary of that club, which is hard to believe it's now been 10 years. But, you know, the biggest takeaway for me in talking to a number of players that came through and met with the media was this is a team that has a chip on its shoulder. And, you know, it's a team that has heard what's being said about Chicago and the club that the Cubs have built. It's a team that has heard Jason Hayward's comments about the Cardinals having an aging core. You know, it's interesting, here we are talking about the Cardinals as a potential underdog when this is a team that won 100 games last year. They won three straight division titles. But, you know, all this chatter, all these expectations in Chicago, they're being written down here, at least in the minds of the players here. So just an interesting kind of back and forth. And also for me, you know, it kind of elevates the excitement of what I think is going to be a terrific rivalry between the Cubs and the Cardinals moving forward. Just a lot of ground there, I think, that's going to be covered in the next several months.
Well, I mean, it's always been one of the best rivalries in baseball, especially when the teams are competitive. And that's, I think, the point that so many were making is, you know, hey, you know, when two teams are great like this, that is when it's fun. Did anybody cross any lines? Did you sense a little bit of heat here and there with anybody?
Close. I wouldn't say they got that far. You know, it was interesting. You know, these two clubs even had dueling fan fests. You know, the same weekend that the Cubs were having winter warm-up, the Cardinals were having winter warm-up, the Cubs were having Cubs convention. You know, and the reports were read up there about how Jason Hayward was reading the nasty tweet sent to him by fans in St. Louis, and kind of the reception that he and Lackey received up there. I wouldn't say any lines were crossed here. You know, Matt Carpenter very blunt in saying, you know, we don't need Jason Hayward saying things to get us riled up to play the Cubs. It shouldn't take that. A lot of players joking that they're proud to be a part of this aging Cardinals team. Just little jabs here and there, subtle references. And, you know, Mike Matheny coming out and saying, hey, we're going to use this as motivation. You know, he said that he's not necessarily going to stand up in front of his team in spring training and preach it, but I think he realizes that some of the things being said and some of this, again, this idea that the Cardinals should be underdogs this year, it's not sitting well with a number of the players here. So I look forward to April 19th when these two teams meet for the first time on the field. In the meantime, again, there's so much to cover in terms of kind of the back and forth, the subtle jabs between these two organizations.
Yeah. They keep you busy. And, you know, we also, it's a good time to start thinking about some of the new faces. I mean, we're talking even in these first few minutes about some of the Cardinals who have gone elsewhere. What about some of the new faces coming to this team? Can you pick out one or two who you think are, you know, going to be impactful and who fans might like to get to know?
Yeah, I mean, I think you start with the biggest acquisition for this team this winter was in signing Mike Leake. to a five-year deal back in December. You know, and certainly there were a lot of people I know here in St. Louis that were hoping the Cardinals would be able to land a David Price, who they went after very hard and by all accounts came up as the runner-up in that sweepstakes. But, you know, in Mike Leake, the Cardinals were able to land a guy who they believe can be an innings eater. They were able to land someone who's still only 28 years old. So when you talk about somebody who should be in the prime of their career, I think Mike Leake fits that bill. You know, you think about the idea that the Cardinals will be without Lance Lynn this year as he recovers from Tommy John surgery, and obviously without John Lackey, who's now with Chicago. Cardinals, quite frankly, needed somebody to come in that could cover innings. And while the Cardinals, you know, love the upside of some of their young pitchers, still some question marks with injury history and how much those guys can give them. So you know, you look at Mike Leake, his track record, certainly just he's been able to stay healthy. He's been able to give Reds consistently 180, 190, even reached 200 innings before. I think he's going to be a really good fit here. And then it's interesting, too, that his former battery mate, Brian Pena, also ends up in St. Louis. And again, while this maybe wasn't a huge signing, making big waves, his presence could end up being more important than the Cardinals even envisioned when they signed him in November, simply because we're still unsure of Yadier Molina's status, and we're unsure if he's going to be ready come opening day.
Well, to that end, you're right. I mean, there are some massive question marks at that position. I mean, you don't want to overplay it, but I mean, you could. Yadier Molina is a big piece, and that would be a huge, huge situation for this team. Of the two, Pena and Leake, who do you figure to have the greatest impact on this team this year?
I still think it'll be Mike Leake. You know, the fact that he's probably, you know, if he stays healthy, he should be making 31, 32 starts for this team. Again, a team that had some questions in its rotation, I think Mike Leake will offer the stability there. And let's not forget that he's a pretty accomplished hitter as well. When you're talking about starting pitchers, you know, more hits, more doubles than any pitcher in the game since 2010. So, you know, the Cardinals, in the last couple of years, have really been trying to help their pitchers become a little more proficient at the plate as much as can be done. And, you know, Mike Leake will certainly add to that. And being a harder out can certainly wear down an opposing pitcher and make an impact. So he has that going for him. You know, Brian Pena, he is going to have a pretty big presence again. At the beginning of the season, he might get more time if Yadi is still recovering. But I also think as you look into the season, you know, having somebody of his stature, having somebody who's been around this game for as long as he has and has the reputation he does working with pitchers, it's going to give the Cardinals the flexibility to rest Molina more often, do that in a way they haven't in recent years, despite saying that they were going to be more proactive at the time. But, you know, I think certainly the Cardinals hope Mike Leake has the bigger impact, because that would mean, A, he stays healthy, and B, Yadier Molina is healthy for much of the season. But I mean, let's not discount what Pena can also bring in a backup role.
Sitting in today, appreciate the visit, Michael. Let's talk a little Brewers. We haven't had a chance to sit down and discuss this team in rebuild mode, if you will. We wanted to take this week to get to know somebody new, a new face for this team, whether it's percolating up from the minor league system or maybe via trade, that kind of thing. Who sticks out for you? Who's a guy that the fans might be worth taking a little time to get to know?
Well, Dave, their number one prospect is clearly Orlando Arcia, shortstop. In MLB.com's breakdown of the top 100 prospects, preseason last year he was 88, but at the end of the season he was 12. This guy is known as is drafted out of Venezuela. He's a tremendous glove man. He was ready to play in the majors as a teenager from the standpoint of defense, but his hitting was suspect initially. But last year, Biloxi in the Southern Association, suddenly he came up with a 307 average, hit the ball to the gaps with, you know, at least line drive power, and demonstrated he has a total game. So he's suddenly a multifaceted prospect as opposed to just an excellent glove guy. And given the direction of the club with the rebuilding, I would think that if he hits a AAA initially this year, he probably has an excellent chance of being with the big club during the 2016 season.
Do things change when an organization is in the state that the Brewers are in right now? You know, normally GMs, you know, you have the aggressive ones, you have the conservative ones who like to take their time getting guys up. You have other guys who like to, rush him a little bit. There's nothing to lose, right? Would there be any harm in getting him, to the big leagues a little quicker?
I don't think so, and I think that he's somebody that the fan base would be aware of and will be eager to see. I mean, there are a lot of marginal guys currently manning some of those positions for the Brewers, and this is somebody who actually has a legitimate future. You know, I don't think there's any harm whatsoever in giving him a long look. He's, you know, what is to be gained? He's not going to get better defensively. He's already reached a peak there. And the last test will be proving whether or not he can hit major league pitching, and let's get going with it.
I remember when the Houston Astros were blowing things up, and Ed Wade used to talk about it being the land of opportunity. I mean, young players, like, even for that matter, you know, guys with a couple of years under their belt but still looking to really solidify themselves, you know, he kind of advertised it as, well, this is an opportunity for you maybe to get a little head start on other people, get that clock going, whatever the case. But in this kid's situation, we know he's going to be a big league ball player. We know he's going to get there pretty rapidly. You know, that adjustment to big league hitting, how much can we take from his minor league numbers as we try to project?
Well, I think he's still, you know, he's shown a progression, which a lot of guys don't. I mean, they start out hitting 340 in rookie ball. By the time they get to AAA, they're hitting 245. And this guy's gone in the opposite direction. As he's advanced through the system, he's become a better hitter. That's very, very encouraging. Again, when he goes to Colorado Springs this coming season, you can have some inflation of the offensive numbers because they're playing at altitude, and it's an incredibly hitter-friendly situation there. But even having said that, from talking to scouts who have observed him over the seasons, he's got a nice short stroke, he makes contact, he puts the bat on the ball, and it's just a matter of him getting strong enough to hit the ball for some distance. He's never going to be a huge home run hitter, but I think he had 35 doubles this year, which was a career high. And he's demonstrated that gap power. So I think that overall, his offensive emergence has been encouraging.
Yeah, I guess it is sort of hard to say with much certainty when they're, you know, as young as he is. You know, Baseball Reference has him listed as 165 pounds. That may well be the number when he was drafted. I don't know. But, and you do see that, guys drafted or rather signed, out of places like Venezuela or the Dominican Republic or whatever, they come to America and get on the more rigorous training programs and dietary programs. They do put on a lot more strength and weight over time. And who knows really what we're looking at yet with him?
Yeah, exactly. He's slight at this point. There's no question about that. And he looks like a shortstop. He moves like a classic shortstop. So. Yeah, a little bit more muscle, you know, a little bit more development would be okay. I mean, I don't think they want him to change body types. But as you said, you know, he'll have the advantages of better nutrition and a better setup from that regard.
Is there a good comp for him yet, Michael? Is that a silly thing to do at this point in the guy's career?
Well, I mean, people will always throw up somebody's name. I don't, you know, is he Davey Concepcion? You know, the build is similar, the movements are similar. But you need to put that on a guy because, you know, that it creates the expectations of greatness that, you know, maybe nobody can achieve. But he looks a lot like the shortstops that you've seen that are able to field the position, that move gracefully with fluidity, that he has tremendous range and a fine arm. So you can throw out any number of names that wouldn't be out of bounds.
Well, it's kind of a new era. For some of these shortstops, and the position itself has changed so much over the last couple of decades. But Carlos Correa emerged last year as a spectacular young player at that position. He's probably got a little head start on Orlando, but is that the type of player we're talking about? You know, good size, slick fielder. I mean, maybe you see Correa as a guy with maybe a bit more power.
Yeah, that'd be exactly it, Dave. Correa would be a guy whose profile is a little higher offensively. But I don't think there might be much difference in them in terms of the rest of the game. This kid could be that good. I mean, Correa is something special, and this kid won't be, at least initially, the offensive player that he is. But you can see some similarities in their overall, what they bring to the game.
Mark, there's a lot going on with the Cincinnati Reds on and off the field, but let's start with Pete Rose into the Reds Hall of Fame. Help us just sort of piece it all together, if you will.
Yeah, it was something that was surfaced this morning, and they had a press conference at Great American Ballpark today. It's going to be kind of a very Pete Rose weekend, so to speak, June 24th and 26th. He's going to be elected into the Hall of Fame. He's going to have his number 14 finally and formally retired. As you know, of course, Pete is permanently banned on the ineligible list of Major League Baseball, and this required some permission from Commissioner Manfred, which he granted. And then the Reds had to change their bylaws. The Reds Hall of Fame did. They kind of mirrored what Cooperstown did, saying that anybody on the ineligible list was unable to be elected to the Hall of Fame. And the board of directors altered their bylaws and then unanimously elected Pete to be inducted.
Well, I've got to believe that the reaction locally has been profound and very supportive, right?
Oh, absolutely. Pete Rose is, for whatever you want to say about him as far as what he did and all the mistakes he has certainly made in his life, but the one thing that can't be disputed is what he means to Cincinnati. He's an icon here. He's born and raised in Cincinnati, and he's just, you know, a lot of the great moments of Reds history have either his name on it or he was a part of it. And right up, included the Big Red Machine, breaking Ty Cobb's all-time hits record, the 44-game hitting streak, just being a player manager in the 80s. All of it's really with Pete Rose, and that's why he's so loved here. He's the kind of guy that played the game hard, and a lot of fans really identified with that in Cincinnati. And definitely the feedback I've gotten on social media since it was announced has been entirely, mostly positive. Of course, fans wanted this to go a step further and one of these days get into Cooperstown, but certainly that appears unlikely, and that's one of the reasons that also motivated the Reds to do this. Last month, of course, Commissioner Manfred upheld Rose's ban. The Hall of Fame, which is separate from Major League Baseball, basically said they're not changing anything, and Rose remains ineligible. They're not going to change their rules to see if they can get him up for an election. So Pete Rose is going to be 75 in April. The Reds did not want to wait any longer before acknowledging his career, and so they went ahead with this.
Yeah, 75. It's hard for me to imagine, really. It seems like just yesterday. Was he there at the press conference today?
He was. He was there along with Marty Brenneman and Bob Castellini, the Reds owner, CEO. And, Pete was pretty loose through the whole thing. He was cracking a lot of jokes. He was, sometimes a little off color, as he's known to be. He's Pete, and he, for better or worse. But I will say this, he was very honored, though. He paid tribute to the teammates that helped him be great, namely the Big Red Machine guys. But he also was, just very humbled about the about Bob Castellini, making some things happen for him to be elected, and just what Cincinnati Reds baseball means to him. He says, of course, that he's never going to give up on Cooperstown, but that the Reds Hall of Fame is, not a second best type of thing. It's to him, because especially that he's from Cincinnati, it's the top for him, and it's a big deal. So he's really honored and very happy about both the Hall of Fame and the number 14 being retired. And as an additional thing, on a separate weekend, at some point down the road, they're going to have a statue for Pete outside the ballpark as well. So there's going to be, Pete's already all over the stadium, his image, and in the Hall of Fame, some of his memorabilia, but now it's all formally going to be there.
Yeah, I thought there was always like some difficulty in how they could represent him at the ballpark. I guess, very noticeably absent would be the statue, the number being retired, those sorts of things. There had always been the rumor that on the top of the smokestacks, if you look, there are seven bats on each smokestack, and that was sort of a subtle tribute to Pete. I don't know if there's truth to that or not.
There's 14 bats total, and there's other things. There's a rose garden outside the Reds Hall of Fame, adjacent to the ballpark where Riverfront Stadium used to sit. It's where the hit number 4192 landed. They created a rose garden for that. So there's lots of tributes to him inside and outside of the ballpark, but all of it's kind of been under the guise of, well, he's ineligible, we can't acknowledge his career. And I think now that Bob Castellini and Commissioner Manfred have spoken about this, it's been the way it's been paved. The Reds can finally, kind of lift the veil a little bit and be out front about it.
Just really tickled to be joined by Greg Brown, Pirates broadcaster. I don't know. I'd say Cannibal Cumming. I you know, let's raise a Jolly Roger. I don't know how to bring you in.
Well, that's as good an intro as I've had in a long time, Dave. And you know, just because you know, you're going to want to know the full comments, the entire phrase. We actually have a precursor to Cannonball. It's Clear the Deck, Cannonball Coming. So you know, having done these games as a play-by-play guy, how you want to try and alert the fans that you're well aware that it's going to be a home run. But in some of these ballparks, including PNC Park, it's a little bit difficult to know right off the bat. So oftentimes I have to wait and see actually a fan about six rows deep beyond the center field wall has the ball in hand. Then I will say, clear the deck, Cannonball Coming. So you know the drill.
Yeah. It's fun, though, man. It's great because the Pirates have so much. It just lends itself to so many great ones like that, and they are kicking the pants. But, hey, and the fun thing is, too, is you've had a lot of opportunity these last couple of years to really, you know, have some fun with it. All the winning that's been going on in Pittsburgh, and, you know, we'll get to the point of this podcast in a minute, but, from your standpoint, you know, the many years of slogging through some tough, long seasons, I'm sure this has just been an absolute thrill.
Well, it's funny, Dave, because the other phrase I've used when the Pirates win is raise the Jolly Roger, the skull and crossbones. When back in the day, as they say, when a pirate captured another ship, he would hoist the skull and crossbones, and that's raise the Jolly Roger. But I've kidded with people over the last couple of years because it's gotten just a ton of attention locally and nationally. And people want to know the story of it, and they think it's kind of a new phrase. But I kid with them that I said, I've been doing this call for about 15 years, but because they lost so much for the first 10, 11 years or so of it, it got no attention. But now that they've been, of course, in postseason play for three straight years, they've been in a real pennant race going into September four consecutive years, it has gotten a lot of attention. And as you say, It's a ton of fun because winning is a lot more fun than losing.
Oh, man. Well, you guys have been doing plenty of that, and you look poised to doing some more of it again this year. So here's the thing, Greg. I thought maybe this week you could help us get to know somebody who Pirates fans may not have really had an opportunity to get to know yet. Somebody, whether percolating up through the system or acquired via trade, the fans probably should know about going into 2016. So what do you have for me? Who should we be looking at?
Well, Dave, I'm going to go with a guy who I think can make a major, major impact on the team sometime this summer, much like Garrett Cole did in 2013 when the Pirates brought him up from the minors, a former first-round pick. And, of course, Garrett Cole keeps getting better and better now as the ace of the Pirates staff. And I think this guy has a real chance to be an ace, if not the ace himself someday, and that's Tyler Glass now, who was a fifth-round pick of the Pirates 4 years ago out of William S. Hart High School in Newell, California. And the reason I know that is because there have been a handful of big leaguers over the years who have graduated from that high school in Southern California, including my good friend and broadcast colleague Bob Walk. And Bob has had his eyes set on Tyler Glass now since the day we did draft him back in 2011. He's very proud of Hart High School. James Shields, the pitcher, of course, the Padres pitcher now, is a Hart High School grad. Todd Zeal, like I said, there have been a handful. None with, of course, the resume of my buddy Bob, but this guy, Tyler Glass, now has a chance to be a real good one. And I think that the Pirates, they won't say this maybe, but because they're going to want to temper the enthusiasm and excitement of Tyler Glass now. But I think even they are hopeful that he comes up in midsummer and makes a major impact because I saw him in one spring training game last year. I was with another broadcast colleague, color analyst John Wehner. And, Dave, this guy, Tyler Glass, now came out. He pitched one inning, And after the inning, we both took our headsets off and both simultaneously just said, wow. He looked like a man amongst boys, unlike, to be honest with you, unlike anybody we have seen. That includes Gerrit Cole. Glasnow came out and dominated. It was a one spring training game. It was one inning, but it was completely dominant. He looked like he was halfway to home plate by the time he delivered. And he was pitching against, I don't know the names of the guys, but I know they were the big leaguers. They weren't just A-ball hopefuls. These were established major leaguers. He struck out two of them, a 1-2-3 inning. It was completely dominant.
Well, Sobrani, he's a big guy, right? He's like 6'8".
Yeah, he's 6'8". I think he's just 22 years old, but 6'8". And, you know, some guys don't necessarily play like 6'8", some pitchers. You know, Chris Young comes to mind, who over the years, not one of those 95-mile-an-hour guys, but high 80s, and you think, boy, that big body, he should be just blowing people away. But Chris Young has had a fine career, injuries aside, with that tall frame. But Glasnow is a mid-to-high 90s guy with a dominant breaking ball, and he's working on the changeup. And you know, there were rumblings early September last year, and we got promoted from Double A to Triple A Indianapolis, rumblings that if the Pirates needed someone in their rotation, needed a fifth guy, that they would strongly consider, which would have gone against all of the Neil Huntington philosophies of the past, but that there was thought that they would bring up Tyler Glasnow in September. He dominated for the most part at Indianapolis. Thankfully, the Pirates didn't really need him, and they don't want to do that. They don't want to bring up a guy just because they need someone at the big league level. They want their minor leaguers, in this case Glasnow, to be ready because he is ready to pitch in the big leagues, not because there's a need at the big league level. I think that there will be both sometime this summer, that there will be a need of sorts, but that Glasnow will be busting down the door and will be absolutely ready to fill that spot in the rotation.